Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. After 5 years of combat, the British Empire was failing in its North American colonies. After trying and failing to capture the rebel army in the northeast, the Court of St. James proposed a dramatic new shift in the size and scope of the war, believing that the king still had a majority of support in the south. British forces sailed en masse for an invasion of South Carolina and Georgia. After tremendous victories at Savannah and Charleston, mistakes made by the Empire would leave them second-guessing their new strategy. On this episode, we discuss the year 1780 and the Southern Strategy. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 3 of the series, we're discussing the American Revolutionary Era, the people, places, and ideas that defined it, and the political ideologies that gave rise to the world's first truly modern republic. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter at Brady Kreitzer, or by searching Wartime Podcast. You can visit my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, for news, updates, and events. And of course, your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. The year 1780 is going to be a turning point in our study of the American Revolution because we not only see a difference in where it's fought, but also how it's fought and who's fighting it. In this episode, we're going to see the British make another decision based on how to win the war and how to win it quickly. Unfortunately for them, they're 5 years into it, so that plan isn't looking so good. If you recall from the earliest experiences we've had in this season of Wartime, and we've said it a lot, we'll probably say it again, for the British Empire, ending this revolution quickly is really their only option. Remember, as an empire, they have literally an entire world to govern. Any rebellion is one rebellion too many. And the sooner they can end this rebellion, the better it is for them. They stand nothing to gain by allowing the American Revolution to go on from 1775 to 76 to 77 to 78 to 79, and whoops, here we are in 1780. So all the while we've been talking about the British, one of the things we've always prefaced our discussion with is that when it came time to make major decisions in terms of crafting a clear policy toward the American colonies, and then winning the war in the American colonies, they've always faltered along the way. It seemed like every year, there was a new British general in command, with a new grand scheme for winning this whole thing and turning it all around. Remember, the British were looking for someone to end this war swiftly and painlessly, at least as painlessly as possible. Well, by 1780, the painless part is probably gone out the window. But when you look at the dollars and cents, so to speak, the pounds coming out of Great Britain to fight this war, and the terrible toll it's taking on them, you see that the end can't come soon enough. Now, I know it is a redundancy, but I think, especially for this episode, if you've been listening all season, if you're new to Wartime, welcome. It's worth reviewing exactly how the British viewed this conflict, and how they wanted to eliminate or neutralize or suppress the conflict as quickly as possible. Remember in 1775, for them, this was one colony, the colony of Massachusetts, maybe some of the others nearby, in revolt, because most of the major events leading up to it, the Boston Massacre, if you want to call it that, the Boston Tea Party, if you want to call it that, again, all political terms, were occurring in Massachusetts, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So to end that rebellion, again viewing their empire as a collection of colonies, would make a lot of sense to put your emphasis there and try and squash it where it begins. We know that will fail. And the war, which is disastrous for them, will move into the year 1776. In 1776, and for the larger part, 77 and 78, the flavor of the war begins to change. It becomes much less about suppressing the idea of rebellion. Again, that's cemented in the Declaration of Independence. But it becomes about practically ending the conflict. The politics after it can be negotiated later. And to do that, the man in charge, General William Howe, Sir William Howe, he's a knight, will be to capture the rebel army, crush them, and eliminate them altogether. Therefore, the idea is you might not like what the British do, you might have a legitimate political grievance, but if you don't have an army, you can't openly rebel against us. Interesting idea. To do that, William Howe would need to eliminate George Washington. He'd need to eliminate George Washington's Continental Army. And he'd need to eliminate any of the militia groups, the Rangers we could say, the Irregulars, that followed behind. He used a New York City as a base of operations till the end of the war, spoiler alert. And therefore he had an open channel for reinforcements, supplies, and money to flow into the colonies. That was the war in 1776. But very quickly, the British found that was not an effective war. Washington wouldn't fight on their terms, which is a credit to his savvy in that regard. So they went with a new change of command. That's a little misleading. William Howe was still in command in New York. But they brought in a new general from their second base of operations, Canada, to sweep into North America and change the context of the war. Remember, they always viewed this as a regional phenomenon. General John Burgoyne comes into Canada, invades through the Lake Champlain and Lake George and Hudson River valleys. And we see, of course, the Battle of Saratoga, where Burgoyne is pushed back. That's 77. In 78, we see the game change in a big way for the British. Exactly what they didn't want to happen. The French become involved. And the French suddenly give the Americans everything they need to be successful. Money, men, supplies, and as we'll see in this episode and future episodes, a navy. Now, when this happens, the British are largely in a place you never want to be when you'd consider yourself a world power. They are what we describe as reactionaries. Reactionary. They're not setting the policy, but they are reacting to the policy enacted by others. I'm not saying being reactionary signals that you are not a world superpower, but it does show that you are not as powerful as you'd like to be, because if you were setting the agenda and being victorious, the American Revolution wouldn't really be happening in the first place. But this brings us to the year 1780, because we're going to see another one of these major changes, not in leadership, but in, I suppose you can say, philosophy of the American Revolution from the British perspective. And it's sort of pressing the reset button. Well, what do we mean? Well, we know who the commander in New York is now in 1779 and 1780. William Howe was gone. He threw himself a big party on his way out. And a new commander was his second-in-command and political rival, Sir Henry Clinton. And with Clinton's arrival comes what we could call, again, a new take on the war. Now, this isn't so much Henry Clinton's decision. He's a big part of it. But again, this is going to come from the court of St. James. This is going to come from London, from King George and his advisors. There's always been this idea in London that the vast majority of British colonies and British colonists favored what they were doing, building this new world, crafting it in a British image, speak the English language, use the English currency, be a larger part of the larger British economy. That idea had some power behind it. So much so that for many people who didn't support the American Revolution or any revolt in any colony, you couldn't understand why you'd throw that away for self-determination and all the risks that come with it. Economic upheaval, constant chaos, warring factions, power vacuums, those kind of things. And one of the groups that the British in England itself always believed was on their side And believe it or not, these people were in the American colonies. Were the colonies in the American South? When we talk about the American South, we're talking about Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. But also, don't forget, those other two colonies to the south of Georgia, East Florida, its capital being St. Augustine, and West Florida, its capital being Pensacola. We always leave them out. Why? Because it challenges the narrative we're trying to push. 13 rebellious colonies sounds pretty good. 13 rebellious colonies and 3 loyal North American colonies doesn't sound so great. But that's why we're here, right? We're here to get our hands dirty. Well, the belief amongst many in King George's immediate circle was that, you know, think about the First Continental Congress. Georgia didn't even show up. Georgia did not even send a delegation. So the belief is that Georgia, but not only Georgia, the Floridas, East and West, maybe even South Carolina, the idea is these people may still be majority loyal to the crown. Were the British wrong to think that? I would argue probably not. Now, there were many people who were loyalists in Virginia, in the Carolinas, that fled as political refugees when the sort of patriot militia kind of took over the colonies. And they made a very astute argument to the British policymakers. Hey, you have a great resource in the South. Use them. Use them. Remember, all of the fighting, or most of the fighting we've seen so far has been in where? Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey. Okay, Massachusetts. It hasn't been in these southern colonies. So the British will finally operate on that intelligence that the South is still favorable to them or loyal to them. And I really think it was. And they'll have a dramatic shift in how they view the war. And that dramatic shift is take all of our forces that we're concentrating in the North. See what we need to stay there to remain competitive against George Washington. But let's take a whole bunch south. Let's take advantage of these loyal southern colonists. Let's get them on our side and use them to basically isolate and suppress the colonies that are in revolt. That's the plan. Call it the Southern Strategy. It begins in the year 1780, but for the rest of the war, this is what it looks like. Remember, in 1778, we talked about the Battle of Monmouth Courthouse. Many will call that. This was actually a Jeopardy question not long ago, and of course, everyone missed it. Not you, if you listen to this podcast. It was Final Jeopardy, too, which is pretty enticing. The final battle of the North was the Battle of Monmouth Courthouse. It really was. Everything else goes south. So 1780, our discussion today is going to be based on that. When the British move south, what do? We know why they go there, and are they successful? Now, as an aside, as a little bit of talking shop, I guess we could say, I can remember vividly, and I almost guarantee, unless you're from an American southern state, that when you learned about the Revolution, you fell into the same trap, the same trick, the same pitfall that I did in elementary school, in middle school, in high school, and as an undergraduate. If you have a history major, you probably got pretty deep into this. But if you don't, if you're just taking your basic survey classes, which, let's face it, if you want to actually make real money, history's probably not your best avenue. You end up making podcasts. Just kidding. You probably fell into this same trap, too. And here's the trap. We talk about these incredible events that happen up north. Saratoga, Trenton, Princeton, of course, from the American perspective. And then we make this really strange change. Oh, and then suddenly, fighting breaks out in Georgia, in the Carolinas, and the war ends in Virginia. The war ends, of course, will be taught in 1781, but the peace agreement isn't really signed till 1783. And we move on. Here's your test, on to the next thing. And that always sort of stuck with me. And it should stick with you. How does it just change? How do we take this big, giant event that is the American Revolution and just say, oh, this happens, that happens, and it's over? I mean, think about where we leave it in 1780 and 1779, a brutal partisan war, a lot of uncertainty. By no means does it look like the British are losing this war. And then there's some battles down south, and it's over. They surrender. That should leave you unsatisfied. And that probably does leave most of us unsatisfied. But as historians, we have to ask that question. I mean, we have a nice narrative there. It's comfortable. You can make it into, I don't know, a History Channel miniseries. but it doesn't really make a lot of sense. So what I really want to do with these next few episodes, 81, 82, and of course today, 1780, is talk about what the Southern Theater is all about, why they went there, the British that is, and really what they had to gain. Because I'll be very frank with you, they had a lot to gain. But like everything we've seen so far, they're going to blow it. And they're going to blow it for a lot of very familiar reasons. There's no really easy way to do this. I'll admit that going forward. Again, we have a 45-minute podcast. 15 of it, we've just spent talking about background and a lot of really my opinion, I guess. So what we're going to do is talk about the war in the South. We're not going to talk about every battle. Again, I'm not a battle guy. Battles happen, but I'd much rather have you understand why the battles occur than what the minutiae of the battle actually is. Nothing wrong with that. I love a good military sort of exegesis breakdown of a battle. But for our purposes here on this podcast, we just aren't going to do that. And again, nothing wrong with that. I think it's a very worthwhile pursuit, not my cup of tea. Instead, I want you to think like the British would have. And everything else makes a lot of sense here. When you're going to move a massive military operation, the size the empire had, and it was a huge one, into an entirely new world, as far as they're concerned. I want you to think about the American South. If you've ever been there in the 21st century or 20th century, a lot of the hallmarks are still in place. If you look at New Jersey or New York, you look at very temperate climate, cold winters, warm summers. That's what we'll say. Farming for, say, maybe 7 months out of the year if you're lucky. And again, most of the time you have to live in two different worlds, a very hot world and a very cold world. That's what a seasonal place is, and still very much that way in the American Northeast. But think about the South. Do they have a winter? Yes. Is it ever cold? Not really. It's always sort of just warm in the winter months. In the summer months, forget about it. It's incredibly hot. It's incredibly humid. The wildlife starts to take over the countryside. You've got these exotic trees with Spanish moss. You've got swamplands, steaminess as a way of life, these kind of things. Again, when you think about the American South, it's a very different world. It's a wild world in the minds of most visitors. In the 18th century, magnify that times 100, and you'll see how the British view the American South. They've never been in a swamp. They've never been in these sort of coastal islands of the Carolinas, hurricanes, things like that. I mean, that is as far from fighting George Washington in 4 feet of snow that you could have. Remember, 1779 was the worst winter on record to that point in North America. So you're getting into a very different world here, and the British understand that. What they also understand is, as wild and as vast and as untamed as the South is, in order to really control it, it's not as hard as it seems. So what do we mean by that? Well, let's take, for example, the state of Georgia, at that time, the colony of Georgia. Today, you have the biggest city in Georgia being Atlanta. Atlanta did not exist in the age of the American Revolution. Really, all that the colony of Georgia is two major cities. One is a coastal city called Savannah, and the other, far less consequential, but still there, was a city that's still marginally small by today's standards, Augusta, Georgia. And the rest of the colony was sort of up for grabs. It was sort of swampy and nasty and hot. There were plantations, things like that, but when you're talking about the bulk of the population, you're really dealing with those two places. I mean, Georgia was as sort of day and night as you could get in the American colonies. Majority population in two cities. The rest is there, but it's, you know, sort of uninhabited, and we can guess, we could say, in a way. So for the British, I mean, taking control of that colony is not going to be that hard. You get Savannah, and Augusta would probably fall on its own. I mean, that's the idea, and that's what the British will do. Remember, just like in New York City, the British need an entry point into the South. They need a place they can take, hold, command, and bring in reinforcements and supplies, sort of be their outlet to the world. And early on, Savannah is that place. Now, this doesn't happen in 1780. I mean, this shows that the British are leaning this way toward the Southern strategy for some time. The British will capture Savannah in the year 1778. And it will be a large battle. It will be largely a naval battle between the British themselves and the American and French forces. But the city's captured, and the city will remain there in their hands. The joint French and Americans will try and recapture it. It'll never work. So just with that victory, capturing Savannah, holding it till the end of the war, mind you, the British basically secure the entire colony of Georgia for the rest of the war that we know it as. Of course, for them, they don't know when it's going to end. So don't treat taking over the South like such a daunting task. They also believed that if you captured Savannah, Augusta would probably just give up as well. Not even give up, but just express their loyalty again that, hey, we are still British. I mean, clearly, if they took Savannah, they could take Augusta if they wanted to. So that's kind of the idea that we have there. This takeover of the South not being exactly as dangerous as we think. Georgia effectively will fall by 1778. But we don't want to really say that's the beginning of the Southern strategy. I mean, maybe that's like the beginning for the preparation for the Southern invasion. Because the real beginning of the Southern strategy comes in the year we're discussing here, 1780. And that comes from Sir Henry Clinton. And it focuses on the major Patriot stronghold of Charleston, South Carolina. Now, what's the big deal about Charleston? Well, this gets us into one of really two major battles we're going to be discussing this week. Charleston is what I call the Boston of the South. And I say that because think about what it is. I mean, it's a port city. And again, think about what the British need to do. Move troops in and out of the Atlantic Ocean into North America. Yes, they have Savannah, but Savannah, as beautiful as it is not exactly enough for them. I mean, Savannah's not what we call a coastal city in the traditional sense. If you've ever been there, it's a beautiful city. The ocean is not far away. You travel a bit by river. But it's not right there on the ocean. And for that reason, Savannah's important, but not ideal for the British. Charleston is very different. So what's the big deal about Charleston? Well, if you can visualize a map, Charleston kind of looks like this. Charleston sits in from the Atlantic Ocean a bit. And of course, so how silly of me, I'll tweet out this map on my Twitter feed, at Brady Kreitzer, or just search Wartime Podcast, you'll see it. Maps are very important for this. It sits in the water. It's at the sort of inside of a bay. That means that the edges of the bay kind of extend around it. It almost looks like it's surrounded by two pinchers of land. And of course, Charleston sits on the inside. That's a pretty ideal scenario for the British. Not indifferent, by the way, than what Manhattan Island looked like, sort of surrounded on either side by Long Island and Staten Island. South Carolina is an incredibly important colony for the British in 1780 and before that. We'll talk about some figures here, but you have to understand this to understand how different things really were there. Because even though we tend to say, well, most of the population's in the North, that's true. The North is sort of industry-driven. The South is much more agricultural. We covered this in very big detail in Season 1 of Wartime. The other amazing thing is just how much money southern colonies like South Carolina produce. Now, chew on this figure. Think about the whole British Empire. You have colonies all over North America, all over the Caribbean. You have colonies in Africa, India, and beyond. All of the money generated by those colonies, make them one big pie chart. Of all of that money, anywhere from 30 to 35% of the entire empire's wealth comes from the one colony of South Carolina. I mean, that is insane. All of that, the entire world, anywhere from 30 to 35% at the time of the Revolution comes from South Carolina. So to capture the city of Charleston, which really effectively was the colony of South Carolina, a little bit different than Savannah and Augusta, but still most of the population of South Carolina was there, would be a huge feather in the cap for the British Empire at this time. But the problem is, attacking it is not easy. It's heavily fortified and controlled by an American commander named Benjamin Lincoln. When he was there in preparation for this, he fortified the entire city. Charleston, if you can't really visualize it, kind of looks like an arrowhead. It shoots out into the bay. It's like a triangle. And the American patriots who control it built a huge dividing rock ditch and wall along the base of the triangle, so that if the British would attack by land, they really would have a hard time breaking through. If the British would attack by sea, remember, it sits in a bay. Two American forts on either side of the mouth of that bay would protect them. I mean, Charleston's a very tough nut to crack. If you're going to attack it by sea, if you're the British, you're probably not going to be very successful. Because you're sort of going into a bay, you're surrounded on all sides by the enemy. You may or may not be victorious, but you absolutely, positively must have ground forces to take that city. Now, what's changed in 1780 is that the administration of the British Empire has finally gotten on board with this plan. They are willing in 1780 and capable of going full bore into the American South. All the money you need, all the men you need, all the supplies you need, whatever you need to take control of the southern colonies, to bring up huge waves of loyal support in the southern colonies, you have it. And things change for the British for that reason. Well, in 1780, Sir Henry Clinton will take a group of soldiers out of New York, sail them far south of Charleston, in what is today the Sea Islands of South Carolina, land them there, and have them march northward to the city of Charleston itself. That's the plan. Why is he doing it? Well, in the lean times, taking Charleston may not have been possible. But now, in 1780, with the full support of the Empire, you can institute a long siege. You guys know what a siege is if you listen to any of our episodes of Season 2 on the Ancient World. A siege basically works on this principle. You can build walls. Walls are great. They keep a lot of people out. But walls can just as easily, and never forget this, walls can just as easily keep you in. And that's the idea. The British want to march forces through the Sea Islands of South Carolina, around to that great ditch and wall built by the Patriots, and surround them via land. They'll bring in the British Navy to blockade the mouth of the port, never engaging, but just stopping any supplies from getting in. And they basically turn the tables on the people in the city. You build a wall to keep us out. We can wait. We'll be here. We're going to keep you in. And that's how a siege works. And the British will do it immaculately in 1780. The siege of Charleston begins in April. It'll last about a month. And as far as sieges go, that's not terribly long. Now, not to get too much into this, but I want you to understand the history of the siege, because I think it's telling. When you look at the continent of Europe, something that's sort of floating around, it is relevant, but not always brought up. One of the things you'll find is that every major power in Europe kind of has a military specialty. For the British, no doubt, it's their navy. For the Prussians, the Germans, it's their cavalry. No surprise. For the French, however, it's their siege work. And that's interesting. Because the French are really good at two things. One is building forts, and the other is taking forts. And that's the idea. They're really good at that. And for the British, now that the French are involved, to surround Charleston by siege and take the city, it kind of adds a new dimension to this, because they kind of feel like they're besting the French at their own game. Now, I don't mean to do this too much, but it's unavoidable, and why not? In my new book coming out, Hessians, I spend a lot of time on the siege of Charleston, because one of the people you follow for a third of that book is literally on the front lines of that march and that siege in 1780 all along. So when you read my book, Hessians, one of the things you'll find is that you really go inside the siege of Charleston, not from inside the walls, not from the Patriot perspective, but from the outside, from a group of people who feel like they're getting the best of them. And you see it very differently, and it's really, really impressive for understanding the entire totality of the battle. Not impressive as in my book is impressive, but just understanding both sides in an event where you rarely hear that really goes a long way. But I digress. In April of 1780, the siege of Charleston begins. It'll last all the way until May. And the siege is really broken for two reasons. One is that early on when the siege occurs, the Americans are actually doing quite well. I mean, they're surviving. And the British are a little perplexed by this. And what they find is that there's actually a river that flows from inland, right, out toward the sea. And the Americans are supplying themselves via that. That will be captured and taken by a British officer named Bannister Tarleton. We're going to talk a lot about him. But when that happens, the Americans really are cut off. The British will unleash an enormous artillery barrage that will really bring the Americans in Charleston to their knees. And Benjamin Lincoln, the commander inside of Charleston, is forced to surrender. The surrender comes in May 12th of 1780. Now, is that a big deal? That's a huge deal. That's a huge deal. Again, we can kind of fool ourselves into believing that the longer the revolution goes, the better it is for the Americans. That isn't really the case. And in fact, very few wars fit that mold. I mean, really look at a lot of the wars you might study on your own, and you'll see that often long wars change on a dime. Time isn't necessarily always working against one side or the other. But Benjamin Lincoln, the American commander in Charleston, will surrender. And how many people does he surrender? Over 5,000. Hit the brakes. Benjamin Lincoln surrenders 5,000 able, capable, active-duty American soldiers to the British. If you're keeping score at home, this is, in terms of men captured and potential benefits in the future, the capture of Charleston is the single greatest British victory of the war yet, and we're 5 years into it. Think of that. That doesn't bode well for the Americans. The greatest British victory of the entire war doesn't come until 1780. So if you're British and you're looking at this invasion of the South, man, it looks pretty good. Charleston, epic and important. If you live there, seek this out. If you want to visit Charleston, a lot of great food, a lot of great arts. Don't let the Civil War history overtake you. I mean, you know, it's really cool as well. But there's a pretty profound American Revolutionary history there as well. Now, let's continue on with the year 1780. Charleston is in British hands. Savannah is in British hands. All looks well. The question becomes, will the Southern strategy work? I mentioned the name of one officer already who captured that sort of auxiliary river that really allowed the siege of Charleston to be successful, a guy named Bannister Tarleton. And this is a very interesting and very compelling character. Tarleton is an empire man, there's no doubt. He's born in the United Kingdom. He believes in the British Empire. By the end of his life, he'll be Sir Bannister Tarleton. He's a leader of what we call light cavalry in the British Army, which basically means you have the major cavalry that fights in battles, does reconnaissance. Light cavalry has a little bit more of an ambiguous resume. They kind of go in and out of places secretly. They get involved in a lot of pretty nasty battles. And because of that, nasty things happen. Now, after the capture of Charleston, Bannister Tarleton will lead his men and he'll attack an American force at a battle we call the Battle of the Waxhaws. And when that happens, even though Tarleton's basically outnumbered 2-1, he has about 150 men with him. They do capture the American patriots. They capture the soldiers. The Battle of the Waxhaws is a British victory. But this is where Bannister Tarleton's legacy and legend begins that I think really permeates the Southern campaign in a very real way. The story goes the American commander was surrendering to Tarleton. Someone shot Tarleton's horse, leading to an outburst of violence and rage and unprofessionalism, we'll say. And Tarleton orders that all of the Americans be killed immediately on the spot. No quarter is given. And as far as the historical evidence for this goes, I mean, we don't have a lot of the figures on how many people die exactly and if Tarleton did this, but he never really disputes it. He does say he lost his cool. He does say that his actions went down in a less than traditional manner. But for the Americans in the South, Tarleton will go down in history as a real goat, a real villain for what he does. They refer to the act of killing prisoners as Tarleton's quarters. That's what they'll say. Because again, to give quarter is to surrender, right? Is to protect a surrendered man. Tarleton's quarter, very sort of facetiously, is to kill all of your prisoners. So again, think about what the British are trying to do in the South. They believe there's loyal support. They want to feed off of that. They want to inject themselves into it to show the people who live there that they are still in charge and rally them to their cause. And they do have a lot of effect, but not as much effect as they could have. Again, remember I said we always talked about the Revolution was always viewed in thirds. One third of Americans were patriots, one third were loyal, one third just didn't care. That's very much an old axiom that really should go away. Because I think a much more representative figure is 25% models. 25% of Americans were patriots supporting revolution. 25% were loyalists supporting staying in the empire. And really the larger portion, the middle 50% of the country, that's everybody but the extremists, really supported whatever army was on their front lawn at the time. Again, it's a political war. And this is no more prevalent and no more prominent than in the South. Whenever we see that, and you see a figure like Tarleton emerge, and the rumors of what he does emerge, this really serves to, I think, push a lot of citizens away from the British Empire. They don't want to be a part of something like that. And it stirs up a lot of, I guess, opposition, you could say, that's unconventional. One of the really powerful things about the war in the South, for me, is that very rarely is it the Continental Army versus British regulars. I mean, more often than not, it's this terrible partisan warfare that we've already talked about, this neighbor versus neighbor ideology and philosophy. I mean, that's what it is. It's very brutal, and it's very terrible, and there's a lot to that, I think. You're going to see people pop up like Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox, sort of this hit-and-run expert. I do not recommend this film, but the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson, he's a made-up character and largely what I would call made-up war in a made-up story, but he kind of uses Francis Marion's tactics. The Gamecock, Andrew Pickens is another one. I mean, these are not generals. These are not trained military men for the most part. Some of them do have experience fighting in the Seven Years' War a decade earlier, but these are people who are leading insurgencies, and the insurgency, the guerrilla fighting, is no more real for the British Empire than it is in the American South. Now, I want to end today's episode in 1780 with a discussion very briefly, and I mean briefly, but boy, we could talk for a long time, of one of my all-time favorite battles of the entire war. Check that. I will say it, my all-time favorite battle of the war. It occurs in the fall, October of 1780, and I think it's so brutal and so terrible that I think it best illustrates the American Revolution as I see it, the catastrophic event that I see it as, than anything else we've talked about. And it's called the Battle of King's Mountain. Now, how does this go down? Well, after the capture of Savannah and Charleston, you have to imagine the British feel pretty good about themselves, and the population of the American South is on notice. But there are some people in the South, and this is going over the mountains now, toward what is today Tennessee, that feel very differently about the war than most Americans in the East. These are mountain people. Today, they'd probably have their own reality show on the History Channel. But they live off the land, they hunt for their food, they live in the mountains, they have probably long beards. You guys get the picture. And they don't really take sides in this conflict. I mean, they don't like the British Empire. They don't like the authority the Empire has over them. But newsflash, they don't like the authority the Americans want over them either. I mean, they don't like anyone telling them what to do. You want to talk about small government conservatism. These people are almost in the Dark Ages, living in the mountains of Tennessee. And when the British move into the South, they do so with a level of hubris that's probably, we can say easily, counterproductive to their overall mission. Well, one of these British commanders, who's a relatively low-level leader, is named Patrick Ferguson. And Ferguson has the duty of sort of cleaning up the loose ends of the British army in the South. If there is loyal support, he has to find it, have them come and join them, right? Protect the Southern cause, protect the Southern army of the British Empire. Ferguson, though, is heavy-handed. He's arrogant. And he does it in ways, again, that aren't going to help his cause. A whole population of people live in the mountains of what is today Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina. Again, They have a problem with the British Empire, but they have a problem with the United States as well. I mean, they want no authority over them whatsoever. And Patrick Ferguson basically sends out a memo to them, into their communities, saying, come join the British cause now, or suffer the wrath of the British Empire. Now, when you're dealing with a lot of people who hunt for their living, quite literally, they're proficient with a rifle. They shoot better than probably anyone the British Army has to offer, because they do it every day. They don't like government. They're very belligerent toward it. It's probably not a great idea to give them ultimatums involving their death. That's a good way to think of it. But again, Ferguson, representative, I think, of the British Army in the South, feels very good about where they are. They feel like they're negotiating from a position of power. The Americans can't stop them. They'll take over the South, they'll use that support, sweep into the North, and that's the end. Well, that memo, and it's something about sword and fire, it's all very poetic, but it basically is a big screw you, I think, pardon my language, to the people of the mountains in Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina. Join the British. Then it agitates them. And a lot of these mountain folks come pouring out of the hills, looking for a fight. They say, if you want to start a fight, if you're looking for a fight, we have one for you. And Patrick Ferguson is not prepared for this. Now, Ferguson has about 1,100 men with him when these about 900 mountain people come pouring from the hills. And sensing that a battle is going to occur, Ferguson does what he best can, and he takes position on a hill called King's Mountain. King's Mountain is not named after the King of England. Let's be clear about that. It's named after a man whose last name was King, who was a local person who owned the land. And it wasn't really a mountain either. I like to compare it, you know, in honor of Ghostbusters, to a giant Twinkie. That's not a bad way to think of it. Picture a giant hill that's long and skinny. I mean, it's like a giant Twinkie covered with trees. That's a good way to think of it. There's a drop on all sides, then at the top there's a flat sort of plateau. Well, the British put themselves up there, and the American riflemen that come from the hills and the mountains surround him on all sides, and they try and overtake the top of the hill. I mean, that's basically King's Mountain in a nutshell. The British are on top of the Twinkie, the Americans are trying to climb up the sides. I know it's not, like, very academic to say that, but it's a good visual. I mean, at least it works for me, and it makes me hungry. But that's the idea. Now, here's the incredible thing. The end of the battle, the Americans win. The Battle of King's Mountain. It's this major victory, but not a game changer. I mean, it's only a relatively small battle. But here's what's really amazing to me about the Battle of King's Mountain. I always said, you know, Patrick Ferguson, this British leader, was leading a British army of about 1,100 men. But the reality is, not a single one of those 1,100 people were actually from Britain. They weren't from Ireland or Scotland. They weren't from really any other part of the British Empire. Every single one of those 1,100 people on top of that Twinkie were Americans. They were loyal Americans from the South. So the Battle of King's Mountain really throws a wrench into most people's understanding of the Revolution. That's why I love it. You had a British force of 1,100 versus an American force of 900. But not a single one of the 1,100 British forces at the top of the hill was actually British. They were all Americans. The Battle of King's Mountain is a battle of Americans fighting Americans. But what are they fighting over? The values and the defense of the American Revolution. I mean, that is far out for a lot of people. King's Mountain is a national park. I've been there. It's wonderful. Not impressive as a lot of places. It's not Gettysburg. But when you understand what went down there and the social forces behind it, the clash of cultures, the real sort of partisan civil war nature of the fight, it's an emotional place. It's a powerful place. Patrick Ferguson himself will be killed. Davy Crockett's father was one of the American mountain folks leading in that fight. So, you know, I think it's a good place to wrap up our discussion of the early Southern conflict in a lot of ways. Because if you're looking for black and white, if you're looking for straight edges, if you're looking for clear and defined friends and enemies, man, this is not the war for you. The American Revolution is brutal in that regard. Because a lot of those people were, by all intents and purposes, neighbors along the way. So think long and hard about this war. And again, we couldn't have done this since episode one. You know what you're getting into now. It's not as easy as we like to think. But understand just how well-rounded it is, just how deep it is and intense it is, just how much more room for scholarship we have. Because by no means are we done studying this war. I mean, don't go making any mini-series about it yet. On the next episode, we'll be talking about the year 1781. The Southern campaign continues, and the war winds down. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.